This is Mechanics After Hours.
Welcome, welcome once again. We're back in our favourite pub and it is time, it is the time of NAMM, the NAMM show, NAMM show, however you feel like pronouncing it these days.
Damn.
2020 Winter NAMM, and it's a lot of that is what we're going to cover today anyway, is going to be Korg flavoured. We've abandoned the B word for once and we're going for some Korg stuff. We're joined by some of our regular friends. Hello, Telmo. Do you want to give us a little hello?
Well, hello there.
Oh, lovely.
It's always
lovely.
A pleasure to be here.
Amazing. We love having you. We've got Pete and Andy, our usual boys.
Hello,
hello.
Good to see everyone in our little dugout in the pub. Korg have two big synthy ones, and then a piano announcement that, I mean, I don't really care about, to be honest. So let's jump into the big ones. Should we start with the slightly... actually, I think it is slightly less exciting. The bigger one of the two.
Yes. It's a bit... irrelevant in some respects.
Shots fired. Yeah, we actually met that one. They brought it over to our particular neck of the woods to do some videos for. It's a behemoth. It's the ARP 2600. They've done obviously they did the Odyssey a while ago, and it was mini keys. It was really expensive and And then Behringer just went, oh hey, we know how to do it properly. Nah. Now they've got the 2600 going. It's full size, big old two flight cases, one for the keyboard, one for the big bit, and then they also come inside a giant flight case for $3,500 if you want it, and you can't buy it anywhere. It's just going to be all sold out.
Yeah, I mean, chance. What was the number that they said they globally produced?
I heard, well, when they came over to do their video thing, they said 150 worldwide. And then they said, but you know, maybe... So they're not really... I don't think they're committing
say,
to anything.
I can't see it being 150 at least.
Yeah.
Like there's I mean, that to me is sounding more like, you know, almost Europe at this point. I can't see it going.
If they up their production run, that would probably work out. Because in 24 hours, we pre-sold like 14 of them. And I don't think everybody who's ordered those from us is going to get it. To be fair, I think we'll get 10.
Okay, and I mean, they look very... They've got this hand-builtness about them. So I could go with 150 globally for now. I would imagine that, you know, let's give this a go, test the water. If they really go, maybe we'll make some more.
Yeah, I think that was the impression I got from them. But they just didn't want to commit to anything, which is a bit annoying.
That's understandable.
It's supposed to be prudent. Yeah.
Was the original... Do you know, Pete, was the original quarter-inch... patch cables, or was it
inch?
Yeah, because they've gone 3.5 mil on this one, and that upsets me. Reasons unknown,
but it's still
full
physically
size,
still huge.
But 3.5 mil patch cables, like, I don't get that.
I'm starting to doubt my sanity. I'm sure the original's quarter inch. I mean, certainly the Moogs were, at the time, and everything else. And just wondering if 3.5 mil was a thing back then.
Oh,
sort of mid-70s.
So, I mean, then that brings me on. It's obviously going to have 5-pin DIN. And
There was on the keyboard module bit. Yeah. There was definitely 5-pin DIN.
So
there was
5-pin DIN wouldn't have been around for the original, right?
No, I don't think it was.
Well, the two editions is certainly MIDI.
Yeah.
And the filter selector where you could got the two different filter options that were in different builds, and they've combined that.
One of them would have been the lawsuit filter, wouldn't it? I think there was that was the one that Moog sued them for. That was the first one.
So Moog suggesting it was a copy of the ladder filter.
Yes, I believe
so. Which is the only thing that I believe Bob Moog actually patented.
Okay. I've got to protect my only thing.
Well, I think back then a lot of the principles that the synth manufacturers were using weren't their intellectual property, so they were just getting known designs, well, not necessarily designs, but techniques, and then combining them in different units. So it's a bit like... sorry to mention the B word again, but it's a bit like the reverse engineering that I would imagine that Behringer have been doing. A lot of these things, a lot of the individual circuits, not the patent aren't owned by Roland, let's say. You know, it's using a Curtis, let's say the 101 is using, or the 01, as we should call it now, is using a Curtis 3340 chip. And that wasn't exclusive to Roland. It was used by a plethora of synth people. So Roland can't, the only thing that they can, the only IP that they could really protect is the actual aesthetic.
Mm. Right.
To a degree.
So they could protect it, but did they?
Well, I'm not sure about that, but I believe they filed a patent for the TV-303 aesthetic.
Okay.
In sort of trying to curtail, you know, what Behringer had been getting up to. Yeah. But it hasn't really dissuaded Behringer at all. They just
yeah.
And I think that there is enough additions, you know, where they've slightly modified the sort of the control surface, and they've added things like, you know, the extra sequences, and where they've added effects. It's enough changes to the aesthetic that they can say, no, this is not a copy. It's, as we're supposed to say, a tribute.
Oh yeah, the tribute.
This is just a tribute.
But Korg, as far as I'm aware, own, or do they have the license, or they own the IP for ARP?
Yeah, they sort of retroactively bought it before the they did the Odyssey. I honestly can't remember why. I remember reading a thing about it at the time. But yeah, they definitely own the rights to sort of ARP stuff now.
Did
in terms of the name.
Korg own the Sequential name as well? Because I know that Dave Smith after Sequential kind of died at about 87, around 87, where it all went wrong.
Yeah,
in that respect, I know that he worked for Korg extensively, working on the M1. I want to say.
I don't know why you're looking at me. I have absolutely
no. I was looking for inspiration there, and I just didn't. Unfortunately, I didn't get it.
Yeah, so definitely.
It's just my blank face. It's like information that I'm taking in. This sounds good.
Oh wait, okay. Here we go. I've got a little article from the Sequential website about it. Yeah, he did definitely work with Korg. So it was actually Yamaha that did own it. And apparently it was just a goodwill gesture. The president of Yamaha, I'm not going to try and pronounce his name because I'll butcher it, but he just gave it back to him.
Cool. That was about 2 years ago, I want to say, that they got that back. And but still, everyone still refers to it as Dave Smith, really. That's what it's known as.
Yeah, you've got an interesting quote. This is an article on the Sequential website. So it says, instrumental in restoring the Sequential name was Roland's founder, weirdly, a longtime colleague and friend of Dave Smith's. He said, I feel that it's important to get rid of unnecessary conflict among electronic musical instrument companies. I don't think Uli Behringer agrees with that particular sentiment there.
They're all connected.
They're all connected. Selmo, did you know the ARP 2600 was the voice of R2-D2?
Oh wow!
So that's the kind of history that this particular synth has. Have you seen pictures of it?
I did. I've watched a few videos as well.
Yeah.
To be fair, I was quite surprised by the size of it, because everyone's going
it's
short
huge.
And small and smart, and no, Korg is really putting it out there, and
it's one you couldn't really miniaturize in any real way if you still wanted the same aesthetic and footprint.
Yeah. And that's the question, isn't it? They probably could have made it smaller. But
could have done a mini keys and annoyed everyone with it. Although people still bought the Korg Odyssey, didn't they?
I was going to say, it's like there's definitely the practicality of it. You know, I mean, it's like every hell of a lot of people, I think you two, would probably be the best points at all. There we go.
Interesting bit of interference there.
I think you two would probably be the biggest ones. It's like so many people now have access to so much gear, they've got to bring it down so that everyone can fit everything in it. Right?
Yeah.
partly there's that, right? Surely. Yeah. Like, no, I find mini keys piss everyone off, but like,
yeah,
even
certainly.
If you're doing like a module version of whatever, I mean, that's partly what a lot of the Eurorack stuff, some of it, surely. You were talking about like, you know, you explained to me you could make an 808 out of the Eurorack stuff, and that's a pretty small format, whereas you've got now the big, chunky Behringer original thing. It's, I don't know. Putting it into a smaller format is not necessarily the worst ways to go. $3,500 is still a lot to pay for a synthesizer.
To be honest, I don't think it has... feel free to fight me on this, Pete. I don't think it has much... a massive amount going for it as a synth. I mean, I think there's a lot of stuff that's more capable, more interesting, and easier to use. I think the only reason it's desirable is because of the heritage and the look and the usability and the way it's laid out. I think there's better synths. I think the whole appeal is historic.
I would imagine, rightly or wrongly, that a lot of people that have now pre-ordered them doing it in the same way as when Moog released the Model D. It's almost a collectible investment.
I was going to say, it's like, it's one for me and one to stay in the cardboard box and never be used.
Oh, yeah.
Quite possibly. There may be people who have bought two and are going to keep one. But I would imagine the whole limited run aspect, it's very authentically constructed. Mm. Apart from the editions of the modern editions of the MIDI interface, and as I say, the filter options. I mean, size wise, they could have definitely gone the TTSH route because that is distinctly smaller than the original.
Is that 19-inch rack scaled?
No, it's larger than that. I would say
still smaller than the original.
Offhand, it's about. Depends if you want to go metric or imperial, but it's about 2 feet wide.
Right.
Whereas this one looks more like a metre wide.
It's pretty much a metre. Yeah.
And that's why I find it strange that they've gone for 3.5mm instead of a quarter inch.
Because freaked me out because they just handed me this bunch of normal patch cables. I'm like, well, surely you've got something more exciting than that. Because using 5U modular is so much cooler. You plug in, it's...
Yeah, you want something with a bit of heft, something that you get. You know, that would be all part of it. But maybe the original was 3.5 because they bang on in the certainly in the video release that Korg did. They'd say that it was authentic in the respect of the way it's made, in the down to the case and the keyboard and everything.
Yeah,
I do understand that. To be fair, if you want to go full on into this is an actual reissue of what they were doing back in the 70s, then you know they have to keep themselves. To the original, basically, obviously adding the MIDI is quite interesting.
Is it interesting? Is 5-pin din? It's like, come on.
it's just, you know, you see Roland releasing an 88 key MIDI 2.0 keyboard.
Oh yeah.
In a way. The industry is kind of pushing into that direction, and not forbidding, you know, obviously the heritage, but also thinking ahead. And from that point of view, I kind of understand it, and I kind of like. I would say that the product is well designed. I'm not going to say it's not necessarily something that I would get, because I think you can get the same sort of sounds through other routes, but you know, it is what it is.
Your average synth collector or buyer isn't going to be buying one of these. There's just not enough to go round. It's a lot of money.
Yeah.
If someone wanted to give me one, I wouldn't refuse it. But I'm not particularly excited about it. I mean, it's a thing.
You made a lot of. We've definitely made a meal out of something that's we don't think is that exciting. But I do have one final thing for the lame people who actually care. Looks like, according to a forum post, and I don't know how reliable this will be. This is the Vintage Synth Forum. ARP 2600 used tiny jacks or tinny jacks, I don't know, which are apparently 3.58mm.
Oh,
so they're non
random ancient things,
non-standard.
Yeah.
So they've gone for the 3.5 just to keep it.
Yeah,
but it cosmetically
weird.
It looks.
Yeah, apparently lots of people swapped out for 3.5mm if they're restoring old ones anyway, and it was super easy to swap over.
See, so I don't know. That's
there we go.
It's not
so they have
the
kept
same,
it pretty authentic, though.
Yeah.
Oh, you've not got that point.
That's it. No, I'm gonna have to take away my deposit for that.
It's that 0.08 mils that you can't get behind.
Trust me, it makes a difference.
Absolutely.
Shouldn't have done it in the first place.
Oh, man. Let's abandon that one. Bye-bye, 2600. Hello, Wave State. Pete, were you a fan of the original?
Original. Really not that aware of the original in some respects. I mean, I'm aware of the name of the Wave Station, but it was a period of time where I wasn't that involved with hardware. I'd gone... quite into the box at that stage. I wasn't on a mad sort of purchasing streak. I never owned one. I've never used one. But I have to say that the release that they've this new instrument they've released does interest me.
Yeah, absolutely. looks like we're talking 1990 to 94 for the original run. Back in the day.
Actually, that far back, I mean, I was... Yeah, there was a certain amount of hardware purchasing going on, but that one passed me by, to be honest. I never really got into some of the sort of digital synths anyway, and sampling-wise, I was using Akai, you know, sort of S3000s and things like that at that time, and working on samples.
Take us through it.
This thing is substantially much more interesting because it isn't just the sort of... they've taken the essence of the WaveStation, and then they've added the sort of sequencing and sort of that type of functionality from some of their other keyboards. And it's a sort of amalgamation by what I can derive from the videos I've watched and the information that I have in front of me here. I mean, it's definitely something I'm going to consider acquiring. I think it's got a lot of interesting possibilities. And not so much in the sound palette, which is... the samples do seem quite interesting. It's the multi-layer opportunity. I think there's four layers in total that you can build up, and then you can individually sequence each layer.
Yeah.
And it obviously not just for pitch, but for any parameter almost. So that you can have some very interesting, evolving things happening with it.
Yeah, and some pretty complex stuff. I mean, I had a quick overview, sit down with one. It was more of a... this is Luke from Korg just going, oh, here's the thing, you press this play and it makes astounding noises, and it sounded really beefy, and he explained how it worked, and I didn't really follow, if I'm honest. It was
I mean, a bit weird. As someone that's got absolutely no idea, that's me from the ground up, what are we talking about here?
Can't do that, Pete, from the ground up.
From the ground up, right, let's start. Physically, it is a 37-key key bed. Full-size keys.
Right.
No aftertouch, because Korg don't like aftertouch, apparently.
It's in quite a nice, small design chassis. Looks,
Almost like kind of Minilog-esque, or I suppose it would probably be talking about
a bit more chunky than that, in some respects. Certainly deeper. I haven't discerned whether it's just a plastic construction or
it's metal. Yeah, I've seen the thing. Metal top plate. The rest is plastic, but so not a bad way. It's just like Minilog plastic. See, it feels fine.
Did you manage to actually pick it up physically?
Just imagine scaling up a Minilog. So it's not as heavy as a Prolog would be, but scale up a Minilog to about the same dimensions, and it's fine. It's not a heavy synth,
but at the same time, it's not.
It doesn't feel cheap at all. I mean, none of the Korg stuff does. It's always nicely made.
But they've got it coming in at a really decent price.
That's the other 649 in most areas, I reckon.
And obviously that will go down
probably,
you know, in time. So we're talking what the sound that it ships with. They describe them as performances, so ships with over 240 performances. And the performances are the stacked multi-timbral layers. So you've got all your sort of waves that you can modulate and do stuff with, but then you can stack them.
Right.
And then even within the stack, you can actually modulate or sequence each of the layers individually. So you could have one sequence is doing, let's say, a note sequence on one of the layers, but on the second layer, you could be using the sequencer to actually manipulate the filter or something like that. So you can get some very complex...
Okay.
Like a smoothie of functionalities, basically.
Yeah. So going on from that, in total, 740 programs. So I don't know whether they're saying, calling a patch a program or a sample.
I always get confused with this, like the hierarchy. So you've got a performance, a patch, a layer, a wave, I don't know. It gets a bit confusing for me.
And then it goes on 1,000 wave sequences.
What is a wave sequence?
I'm not really sure.
Yeah, this is one of the things that Luke explained that went, hang on, what? Why do I need to sequence my wave? The gist of it that I got, this is probably quite wrong, we need to watch those YouTube videos, is let's say you've got a standard 16-step sequence. You seem to pick a waveform per step of the sequence.
Yes.
And it kind of morphs through
You can step through. So you can, I think, did it say you can load 16 waveforms into...
I think it was 16,
And then you can step through each waveform.
Yeah.
So you can be going through, I mean, you could have lots of slices of breakbeats, let's say.
Yeah.
And they could be, you know, one could be quite a sort of hi-fi one, and then a lo-fi one next door to it, and different sounding, but they're all in time. Let's say they're all same BPM. You could be sequencing through them.
Mm.
So it's, although it's a continuous rhythmic section, it's the tone changing on each step.
Yeah.
You know, complexity. And then they go on to say that the combination of all the variety that you can produce with the performances, the programs and the sequences adds up to literally tens of thousands of user performances that you can construct from it.
So it seems quite versatile. It
yes.
seems like a more of a live instrument than, say, something like the ARP, which seems almost more studio-based.
Yeah, performing live with a 2600 would be a pain in the arse.
Yeah. I do not want to mention the B word again, but it does remind me of the DeepMind to a certain extent with the LCD and everything. Of course, you know.
Visually, I think, would be the only thing. It's super weird.
Yeah, I mean, the DeepMind's DCOs, I want to say.
Yeah. Well, it's just Juno-y, isn't it?
So the DeepMind's an analog synth with lots of digital effects, where these are all waveforms.
Yeah.
I mean, it's got real pianos on it, and they sound.
I didn't hear them, actually. I don't know.
Got real pianos that sound half decent.
Mm.
So, obviously, you haven't got a weighted keybed. You've got the very...
It's just the way it looks, the way it might feel as well. I'd like to see what people would actually do with it, especially because of...
See, to me, it looks a lot more like they've taken the design of the something like the... Not the mini log, but more like the prologue and something like that, and that they've put that together. That's what that more looks like to me.
It's certainly got all the same buttons, the same knobs as all of that kind of series. Yeah,
that's what it's kind of giving
feels
me
like
the
part
vibes
of. Part of the family.
Almost,
the family.
In a way. Not so much the DeepMind.
I mean, they're stating that the sequencing it almost has a door-like... appearance. Mm.
Oh, it certainly had in the LCD as it was playing. You can see the separate sort of tracks or layers, whatever they are, with a little playhead going
and
through
it was
them.
Stepping through them or jumping. You can have a random one which jumping around. This is, I mean, I quite like instruments where it's a conglomeration of all these various aspects, and you can just sit there. Sort of, there's so many different potential combinations of what you can put together. You can just sit noodle away. And just produce sort of magic just by sort of falling on it, basically.
I certainly think it's going to be something that, like, you'll find a couple of people on the internet are just going to absolutely plumb the depths of the thing and make some really incredible stuff.
Yeah, my gut feeling on this is going to sell really well.
Do you reckon it will turn into a classic, though?
Not necessarily, because, I mean, the thing about any digital technology can always be superseded. There's always a faster CPU, there's always something with more memory, do something.
So the same reason that plugins don't really become classics.
Mm.
Whereas your analog synth, I mean, going back to the ARP 2600, a 2600 is a 2600 is a 2600.
Yeah.
And hence why Korg feel confident enough to be able to reproduce it and sell it for quite a reasonable price, because I had a look and secondhand going for about 12,000. So I can see why people are thinking, and you may have people that are already thinking about, can I acquire an original, and suddenly you get a reproduction of an original.
If they've got their 10 odd grand knocking about, I'm there.
Fraction of the price. No wonder they're all sold out.
Hmm. That makes sense.
But yeah, I mean, I'm relatively confident. I could be wrong on this, but my gut feeling, I mean, maybe I shouldn't take this approach, but anything that particularly interests me, I always suspect might be a good seller.
Yeah. No, that's fair enough.
If I want to buy one, lots of other people would normally do as well.
You get that kind of gut feeling.
Yeah.
And it's like, actually, no, that looks pretty good to me. I've had it with a couple of things before, where it's like, even with the sort of synthy stuff, obviously, you know, my background's more to do with recording and things like that. But even with the more synth kind of based elements, it's like, you took a look at Behringer doing the 808, for example, and you knew that was just going to go like off a shovel. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's something that people...
The amount that we ordered when it was available to order.
It tells it. I almost said it's ridiculous, but it's really not, to be honest. It's done its job. And I still want one.
Yeah.
Just to admit.
Who doesn't?
Yeah.
Well, I had a customer today who almost took the words out of my mouth, my usual phrase about the Behringer stuff. It'd be rude not to get one.
Because
he virtually... returned that before I even said it. It was expressing the same sentiment. I mean, there are a price point whereby if you get one, you're not going to feel that your wallet has been mortally wounded after when you leave the...
No, not in this game. Not when Korg are releasing a 3500 synthesizer.
Yeah.
you know, when you're having to pay X amount for...
But we've always seen this with Moog, with reissues. They reissued their modular stuff. That's still available, and that's
horrifying.
Eye-wateringly expensive.
Are we talking about, like, the...
The old modular. So like there was
the
one that they did...
in the living room, like desk thing.
There's one they did recently, which was... it was kind of a suitcase... thing that was two rows of 5U, so we're talking a 10U system. It was only about, you know, maybe a foot wide or something, so not many modules in it. That was well over 10,000 for that.
That's
13,000.
The system 15, I want to say.
Something
it's
like that.
In a kind of vinyl
suitcase-y
covered
thing.
Suitcase. I think I would like to say it's a system 15. I'm off the top of my head, I thought they had a system 15, a system 35, and a system 65.
Yeah,
and
I mean, they're all
the price,
numbers.
And the price went up accordingly.
Mm. Yeah, so this was recent. This was actually...
Was it another reissue or something?
This was even worse. This was a 3P, which is a three suitcase thing. £44,000.
Oh, yeah. I love one.
Wow.
But it's all made up of those individual suitcases. So that's the Moog 3P. £44,000.
So didn't they do a kind of Keith Emerson reissue thing, or is that
it? That was a while ago. I don't know. I didn't know what a synth was when that was. Oh no, this is the one I was thinking of. The Model 10, which is 1971 was the release. That's a single suitcase, two and a bit rows. That one, let's see if I can get a price on that one, because again they're always just
your
limited
website,
built to order, limited quantities, limited time. Come on, give me a price. TBC, amazing. I love it.
Yeah.
TBC.
It's like I was saying to you this morning, Peter, with some of the Moog stuff, it's almost nice in a way that it harks back to even the very early days of people like George Harrison, for example, where it's, I want to get this. This is the latest and greatest thing. I'm going to have to put that in there.
12,000.
£12,000.
That was the one I was thinking of. Model 10, £12,000. Anyway.
I'm going to put that in my studio in Apple Corp. I'm going to put it in Abbey Row. I'm going to give it a try. And that's the kind of cool thing that I think about when it comes to either like some of this reissue stuff or whether or not it's...
He's waving his hands. What's happening?
The reissue stuff or the stuff that comes along is kind of classics. That's where I kind of see the benefit of it, being able to like kind of plonk it in a studio from that point of view, if you've got the money to be able to do that, which obviously an awful lot of people don't do. I think the vast majority of musicians that are kind of going to use this and the people that are actually really going to kind of create the music, it's difficult to kind of see where that point lies. Why would you spend 12 grand on that? I don't understand. Then maybe you guys can help me. I don't understand why you do it. Is it a heritage
successful
thing?
Successful musicians with too much money to burn, or the one you're suggesting, the people with loads of money and want to put it in a studio as an instrumental piece, you know, something the artist could
use. So a large studio owner that feels compelled to have these particular instruments because their customers are going to expect them to be there.
Aren't those things, now correct me if I'm wrong, aren't they severely limited in terms of their capabilities?
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I don't understand.
You'll have people that will argue the sound is... You can't get the sound anywhere else.
No, I completely understand. And I'm...
I don't
agree.
To
some point...
Absolutely
don't
agree.
In some capacities, I'm an advocate for it. In some capacities, I'm not. But what I don't understand is, you know, when people were spending, let's say, 12 grand on something that is either, like we said this morning, shipped right out of a university lab to there... That was because it was, quite frankly, it belonged in a university. It was the cutting edge of what they were doing in terms of what they could achieve sonically in that new field. Whereas we're talking 70 years later? Something like that,
yes,
right?
Yes,
that's we're talking 50s, sort of...
Talking
the original origins are almost that old. It's 40,
oh, really?
Late 40s for the first...
Okay.
Sort
so we're talking
thing.
even later.
However...
Where are we coming at? Like, is this cutting edge or is this just old stuff? Like, is this just, you know, should we be spending more time thinking about what we can achieve now and what's coming out of, say, universities now.
There should be a thin line dividing those two, exactly what a reissue is and what a new product is.
Yeah.
The thing about a reissue, like the ARP 2600, it's mostly about the way. It's about the sound. It's about bringing that nostalgia back from the days. And people pay for that. People pay from sounding, like you said, like people pay for the name of Moog. They don't care how much it is.
See, now this is my thing with stuff like this. It seems like more, if I were a stockbroker and I wanted to put something in a way that's, okay, right, I'm going to buy it and I'm going to pay X amount of tax on it and I'm just going to leave it in its box and it's going to be an asset that I can then, you know, I can sell or it gains value. Fine, fair enough, whatever. A musician's going to use any of this shit? Come on, are actual kind of, you know, people that were using the original stuff in the way that they were because it was new and it was stuff that they can... I mean, obviously, we had the chat to a degree. The ARP 2600 is the same thing. It was going down from that big... what's it?
It was the original, which was the 2800, I want to say.
I think it was a lower number. I'm thinking of it. I can see it in my head. I can never remember the number.
But it was a yeah, beast.
Yeah. And it's going down from that to the 2600 to the Odyssey. Fine, that makes sense. But even now, when you think of what you can accomplish, what is the validity of this kind of stuff? I think, you know, I love Behringer for what they're doing, and they're doing it right. And I'm going to mention the B word again, because they're making that equipment that produces that certain sound at an affordable rate that most musicians can access. Whereas people like Korg or your Moog and stuff like that are just basically writing off their name. Mm. The biggest defender for me is Roland.
Because they are actually pushing forward, even if we don't like it.
Yeah, no, they are, but they're still using their name. They're
How
still
dare
using
they
like
take
the
Jupiter's
yeah,
name.
Yeah, they're taking
name.
Things like the Jupiter's name. They're doing the Juno and they're doing the boutique thing, which, quite frankly, I can get in a plug-in because it is basically a plug-in. Mm. It's a plug-in MIDI controller that you can use outside of things.
And if their boutique reissues are digital anyway, might as
then
well get a plug-in.
Point?
Exactly.
Yeah, what's the point? You may as well just sign up for the Roland Cloud.
But it's because that piece of metal says Roland in it.
Yeah,
people
but it's
are
not
paying
a piece
for
of
that.
Metal, is it, for the Roland one?
It's all plastic.
It's a piece of plastic. And if you've got shovel hands like me, you can't bloody use it. So I don't understand. Yeah. That, see, this is the thing, though. This is where someone like Behringer, which are doing the DeepMind, which is in effectively itself a Juno, you know, that's something that I can use. And quite frankly, it's something that I can afford, or certainly I can see where my investment is going far more than buying something like the boutique. And that means I can play about with that sound and try and come up with something.
You feel better about it.
I feel better about it. I can see where my investment is going because I'm going to use it.
Yeah.
I don't think... And correct me if I'm wrong, and anyone that wants to kind of show me that I'm wrong, I'd be more than happy to sit down and listen to a track. I'd really question anyone that's buying the 12 grand Moog, the 40 grand Moog, the 2600 maybe. Let's have a look. But what are they doing that's new? And using it in a way that those things were designed to be used. They're cutting edge. Why aren't we looking at stuff that's a little bit more out there? You're a big advocate for this. You love weird and wacky.
I do love weird and wacky. I actually had a great chat with Alex Theakston, Mylar Melodies, 2 days ago when he brought some certain secret things over to the shop. But he, what did he called it? We're into the digital era again. So how our analog stuff started to go downhill when things like the DX7 came out, D50, all these really cool... digital synths in the 80s and early 90s.
They're getting more expensive, by the way.
Hmm?
They're getting more expensive with time, by the way. Those digital...
The vintage stuff.
The vintage,
yeah. You were on the lookout for a DX7 recently, weren't you?
Yes, I was, yeah. And they're going up in price, and they're getting harder and harder to find as well, unfortunately.
And you want a Mark II. It's got to be a Mark II. Yeah.
It's got to be the Mark II.
I mean, I sold a D50 last week.
Well, I didn't
even
You sold that second-hand one?
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
So that went to one of my regular customers, already had a D50.
Wait,
it was
what's Andy doing? What, did you buy it?
No, I spoke to that guy on the phone.
No good.
Oh, wait, so are you claiming the sale there?
No, there was an issue with it.
We'll skate over that one. I'll go back to where I was with my chat about the...
Well, you were right. I wanted to say you're right about the... So the behemoth that preceded the 2600 was the 2500, which is the...
The big boy.
Makes sense.
Yep. Big, absolute, massive, serious wiring.
The 2800 is the Odyssey.
Oh.
Yeah.
Fun fact of the day. I like it. There we go.
So I knew there was a 2800 lurking in there somewhere.
I'm going to steal
but
your attention right now.
They're
again.
Saying just the 2500, just to give you, this is the price in 1969 was $100,000.
Oh, $69.
And that's when was it released?
1969.
And that came out at 100. So
100,000.
I mean, Jesus Christ.
Get you on an inflation calculator there.
Yeah.
We'll get
so
update
you
on that.
So you are complaining that it's so expensive. Looking I mean, back that, in the day.
That's got to be almost equivalent to millions now.
It's got
to
be.
Yeah, you're probably not far off. Yeah.
So the idea of the 2600 was to make something affordable that actual musicians could purchase. Because prior to that, the only people that were playing around were the really top-flight professional musicians that could afford the Moog modulars. And then this type of thing, the 2500 was going into universities. It was one of their, we must have one in our sound laboratory, or it's cutting edge.
This is what I mean. If you look at the wider market these days, a lot of people are skint. To be honest, and it's, you know, they need to come up with something to cater to that. It's why things like plugins are really effective at being able to do it. It's why things like Behringer, for example, are really hitting a mark. When you come at it, I don't know what the price point is, to be completely honest, with these kind of things. Maybe you know, you give something like the ARP a little bit of a grace, because it's actually, in the grand scheme of music equipment, it's not that expensive. But my my query with it would be, what are people using it as an instrument? Are people using it as a thing to create different sounds and to create new things, or are they in love with the sounds of yesterday?
Absolutely.
There's a major nostalgic
are recreating that
streak through all this.
And that's what's they're kind of doing. It's, you know, is it the guy that's or girl that's however old and they love that sound and they just want to be able to recreate it, and if you do, power to you.
I think there's a certain amount of and we discussed this when we talked about gas, there's a certain amount of just owning that thing. It's the physical you, I own this. And it's, I would imagine that it's a bit like modular, where people are just, it's just for their own personal pleasure. They'll just sit there and or stand there and noodle with it, and they can do, and it's all exclusively theirs. They might not even be recording artists.
The argument that I'd make with modular stuff is it seems so custom. It seems like that's where that lovely element of experimentation comes in, because
you make the instrument
because
that you always wanted.
The instrument that you always wanted. You're not having it come out of a factory line. Fine, it's hand built. Fine, it sounds like this, that, and the other. That's lovely, but it is what it is. It's been done. You've heard it on the records. You've heard, people have had enough time with them, whoever bought them initially, to get the sounds out of it, because they are limited in terms of what they can.
Yeah, no, for sure, and I totally understand what you're trying to get at with all that. But I mean, the proof's in the pudding. The units will just, if not, they haven't all sold out already, they will be sold out, I would imagine, by the end of next week.
Oh yeah, definitely. Worldwide ones.
Yeah, worldwide. They'll be gone.
It's
worked for Korg, but it's a business venture.
Well,
I know everything is. I know everything is, and I'm being romantic about the whole thing, that, you know, people should do this, that, and the other. That's absolutely fine. It's a business venture. If I were Korg, I'd bloody do it, to be completely honest. But I don't know. Part of me is feeling this, like, you know, leave the dead to rest.
Yeah, to a certain extent. I'm going to grab you right now and steer you back towards the wave station, because we've been ranting down a tunnel for a little bit. But that chat I was having recently, it was, we're looking at the new releases. We want to think forward thinking, what's new and exciting in this reimagining, I guess, of that digital era, the 80s, early 90s, DX7, D50, all those fun things. But now we've got Modal Argon 8, we've got Hydra Synth, we've got Expressive E, Osmos.
Yeah, that looks so cool.
There's loads of new interesting stuff coming out.
That looks now. Amazing. That looks
I think
so good.
It's just going to get really cool. There's really interesting stuff in Eurorack, like Dove Audio with the WTF oscillator, the Window Transform oscillator. That's interesting. That's innovation in the digital world. Like, why stick around with yesterday's technology when there is more stuff to be found? And someone like Korg doing that, when they have been, they can, and they are... doing the whole, oh, look, we made this product this one time. Let's keep doing it. Yeah. But I'm glad to see that there is sort of new stuff happening. Even though they are just bringing back the Wave Station in a way, they're still making new things.
So if I could round this up, obviously, we know that NAMM's just around the corner. I'm sure we've probably touched on this before, but it is literally, I think, next week.
Yep.
What would be, you know, it can be a product kind of thing, or it could be a little bit of a trend at the end of NAMM that you would like to see kind of happening from the perspective of music equipment. What would kind of, you know, you'd be able to kind of get home after you've read everything. It's like, oh, actually, I feel like I can sleep a little bit better now because it seems to be heading in that direction that I want. Ben, please go.
I want to see less reissues from everybody but Behringer. I want to see more companies actually making new interesting designs, even if on balance they're pretty bad ideas or weird ideas. I want to see the weird ideas and people actually making risks, interesting sequences, new interface designs. It's just the whole part of these sort of music shows, technology shows, are like, oh, check out this new cool stuff that we're doing.
Yeah.
I would like to see cool new stuff.
Yeah.
Because this is something, there's so much guitar stuff at NAMM, and it's so often just boring. Like, big companies just going, here's a rehash again.
Yeah, I was going to say, guitars seem to be another thing. I don't think any of us have massive authority to talk about it.
Oh, Telmo does.
Oh, yeah, I suppose you do. That's a good point. Yeah. It seems to every year, new Strat, new whatever. I mean, you know, new Les Paul, for example. Yeah. I thought they peaked Les Paul in 59.
Yeah.
Right? I mean...
they're still just kicking that dead horse because the customers are lapping it up.
I think they just keep trying different stuff and see if it actually works.
What, throw it all at the wall, see what sticks.
Exactly. And especially, like, you give the example of Gibson with the Les Paul. I mean, they've just changed, obviously, CEO last year, which I had the pleasure to meet. He seems to be the sort of guy that really really wants to put Gibson back on top. However, I think the way that these big brands are doing, I think Fender is being the smartest one, as it's delivering the same sort of products consistently for all different sort of pockets.
Yeah.
I mean, there's not really a lot of interesting stuff apart from Abazi guitars. I mean, there's a lot of interesting fanned frets and different temperament guitars.
The
as
little
well
weird brands.
Yes. In terms of pedals, there's really interesting stuff happening in the digital world. The Synesthesia, it's coming out by GFI.
What's that?
It's a multi-modulation pedal that you can, obviously, it's USB as well, so you can plug it into your computer. You can... manipulate the sounds. It's pretty much, if you try the Specular Tempest by GFI, it's within
one,
the same sort of style with a lot more different sounds to it. So I'm quite excited to hear what they will do, or at least what they have to present.
I'll tell you what, maybe we should save this for what you're excited about by the sounds of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If I just keep going into what you want
for NAMM, because that's
basically all I've done
my bit.
Yeah, yeah. Oh,
what
fair.
Do I want for damn? For goddamn damn.
goddamn NAMM.
I don't know. There's this one thing that I'm particularly trivial about. It's the Boss Wazacraft headphones.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't know if you guys ever came across one
very
of these.
Very vaguely.
Yes. So I've seen one. I didn't get the chance to play through it. So it's basically... an amp in a room simulation headphones.
And a big old wireless dealio, isn't it?
Yeah.
Exactly. So it seems a bit too technological for me from a guitar player perspective.
Have you got valves in your innards then? Yeah, you're a valve man.
I'm a valve man. Okay. I'm very much... I do appreciate some of the... well, at least with my guitar playing, I'm really into the essence of what a guitar sounds like.
So for your birthday, you need the new Neural DSP floorboard thing, don't you?
it's like 20 times as... stronger in terms of like chip power than
I was not paying attention at all.
Like that. No, but yeah, I did read something about that. Yeah, so really exciting stuff. But then again, there's so much products to look after. Pete, yeah. What are you really looking after?
I'm not really. I'm going to just let it wash over me. Because it's... Yeah. A lot of the we've had a lot of announcements already in the preamble as we sort of go into the winter show. It will be really. I like to be surprised.
Yeah,
I hope we can be surprised. Yeah, and it's not just kicking dead horses.
The thing
everywhere.
Is, most manufacturers, certainly the bigger ones, they're not going to take any real strategic risks.
Nope.
It's at the end of the day, it's a business, and if they're sort of quoted on the stock market, then they can't take any risk because they're answering to their stock the shareholders. So
that's a fair point. That's a very fair point.
And with some of the manufacturers, what we've all got to understand, certainly someone large like Roland isn't just a musical instrument maker. They make a massive range of things.
Yamaha rings a bell as well.
Yamaha certainly an even potentially even bigger manufacturer. And so the musical instrument side of things isn't necessarily the biggest part of their business.
Mm. Yeah, totally.
So, knowing the way that some large corporations are sort of strategically carved up, so they have sort of internal channels or teams, and they'll have the responsibility for profitability within that stream. So, it's going to sort of deter anyone taking any real risks with a sort of a real left field product that's potentially. Might not fly at all.
So it's up to the little guys to save us then?
Well, the little guys, but look what happens to the little guys. Either it's all or bust sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, they might have a hit on their hands.
They become big.
And then they get bought by somebody.
Well, then, yes, if that's always a possibility. Or even though that particular product's a hit, the next one down the chain doesn't work out so well for them.
Yeah.
We've seen that with a variety of companies. It's most probably quite a hairy old thing. I mean, you've got to sort of design and develop, and then you've got to try and manufacture this. I mean, depending on what quantities you're expecting to sell, you might want to fabricate that locally, or you get to the other extreme where Behringer just... I don't know if they've got...
Outsourcing everywhere.
Do they just outsource everything, or do they have... I heard a rumour they were getting their own factory together out in China or wherever they fabricate.
Yeah, that would... I guess that would make sense if they can invest there.
But that's not a hard thing because they've got established product lines, they know what they're about, so they, you know, it's just trying to get it into the geographical area where you can fabricate this stuff as cheaply as possible. Which is what, you know, the consequence of globalization, isn't it?
Yeah.
But then you've got the other hand, the other side of things where you get the prestige brands where, you know, if you go to the extreme of something like Moog, it's all hand built in
Nashville.
So I mean, that's the opposite extreme. So they've not only got those type of constraints, there is a productivity, so they can only fabricate so many units because it's down to manpower. And they're expensive to fabricate because they're going to be quite high cost employees. They're living in a relatively expensive country, or they're fabricating, so that the complete
sense.
Other end of the other end of the stick.
And that's a really good way of selling a product as well, is by...
The exclusiveness of it. The fact that it is, you know, it's almost, you know, it's signed by who, you know, the particular person that made it.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you see that in the guitar world at all, with the higher end, with the custom shop stuff.
Oh, there are definitely some luthiers, that you want to get a guitar made by.
Mate, you can get all sorts of guitars from any other country in the world at NAMM. In terms of the big brands that we know, you can get anything you want. Like Fender has a massive custom shop line. You can pretty much go to their website and build a guitar from scratch. It will be unique because you will be building it. So you can almost ask the builder to sign it in the back of the neck as well. So I mean, it's very interesting. And as long as it feeds you as a musician, then you will be fine. You will be fine.
There we go. A nice place to leave it. We'll probably see you same time, same place next week when... How long is NAMM? Is it a week?
Finishes up on Friday next week, I think.
Oh, yeah, in that case, we'll be on the other side and we'll have been washed over, by, as Pete says, by so many videos. We'll try and maybe keep a wrap-up nice and brief, but we'll see you there. Have an excellent week.